We look at it from a fairly restricted zone in space, and it always seems, whatever the season of the year, because we're so far away from it, that those stars in the Big Dipper are in the same position. But imagine looking at it from somewhere else in space altogether, and those stars would not look like a dipper. They'd be in another position. Now then, what is the true position of those stars? Don't you see there isn't one? Because wherever you look, the position alters. You could say that the true situation of those stars is how they are looked at from all points of view, all possible points of view. Inside the constellation, looking outwards, outside the constellation, looking inwards, from everywhere and everywhere. But you see, there is no such thing as the truth. The world, in other words, is not existing independently of those who witness it. Because the world is precisely the relationship between the world and its witnesses. Just as the sound of a drum is the relationship between a striking hand and the skin. If there's no skin on the drum, it doesn't make any sound. And so if there are no eyes in this world, the sun doesn't make any light, nor do the stars. So what is a relationship. You can, for example, prop up two sticks by leaning them against each other, and they will stand. But only by depending on each other. Take one away and the other falls. So in Buddhism, it is taught that everything in this universe depends on everything else. That we have a kind of a huge network, and this is called the doctrine of mutual interdependence. All of it hangs on you, and you hang on all of it, just as the two sticks support each other. And this is conveyed in a symbol which is called Indra's net. Imagine a multidimensional spider's web in the early morning covered with dewdrops. And every dewdrop contains the reflection of all the other dewdrops. And in each reflected dewdrop, the reflections of all the other dewdrops in that reflection. And so ad infinitum. That is the Buddhist conception of the universe in an image. The Japanese call that jiji muge. A ji means a thing event, a happening. So between happening and happening, mu, there is no ge, separation. Jiji muge. Now, so the first phase of the Eightfold Path has to do with one's view, understanding of the world. The second phase has to do with action, how you act. And here we get the Buddhist view of behavior. A Buddhist doesn't base his ethics on the idea of commandments, of orders from a higher echelon of authority. Buddhist idea of ethics is based on expediency. If you are engaged in the way of liberation and you want to clarify your consciousness, doing that is inconsistent with certain kinds of action. So every Buddhist makes five vows, five precepts. And you may perhaps have heard the Buddhist formula of taking what is called Panchasila, the five precepts. And they take what are called tisarana, the three refuges and the five precepts. The refuges are the Buddha, the Dharma, the doctrine, and the Sangha, the fellowship of all those who are on the way. So the priest, the bhikkhu, the Buddhist monk, and the lay people will chant the formula. Buddham saranam gacchami, dhammam saranam gacchami, sangham saranam gacchami. Those are the three refuges, the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. Then they take the five precepts. Panatipata veramani sikapadam samadhyami. Adinadana veramani sikapadam samadhyami. Kamesu michachara veramani sikapadam samadhyami. Musavada veramani sikapadam samadhyami. Kamesu michahara sura merya majapamadatana veramani sikapadam samadhyami. So they take these five precepts. Panatipata. I undertake the precept to abstain from taking life. Adinadana. I undertake the precept to abstain from taking what is not given. Kamesu michahara. I undertake the precept to abstain from exploiting the passions. Musavada. I undertake the precept to abstain from falsifying speech. Sura merya majapamadatana. I undertake the precept to abstain from being intoxicated by sura, merya, and majapamadatana, whatever they were. I presume toddy, which is alcohol. I don't know. I don't know what else it was. Nobody does know. Because you see, if you start killing people or taking life, you're in trouble. You set up an opposition, and you've got to become involved in taking care of it. If you start stealing, you worry people. You upset people's orientation in life, because if you suddenly come into the back home for dinner and find somebody's stolen your table, where are you going to serve dinner? If you exploit your passions, it means that when you feel bored and somehow that life is a little bit empty, you say, well, now what are we going to do this evening? Let's go and get stuffed. You know, a lot of people who suffer from obesity are trying to simply fill their empty psyche by stuffing themselves with food. Well, it's the wrong cure. So, likewise, musavada, if you start telling lies to everybody, you know what happens when you start telling lies. You have to tell extra lies to cover up the first one, and you get into the most hopeless misunderstanding. Speech collapses. And, of course, the intoxication is the same problem as the exploitation of the passions. So there's a purely kind of practical, expedient, utilitarian approach to morals. There's another side to this which doesn't enter into the precepts, which I will explain later. Then the third phase has to do with your mind, with your state of consciousness. And this has to do with what we would ordinarily call meditation. There are the two final, the seventh and eighth aspects of the path are called Samyak Smriti and Samyak Samadhi. Smriti means recollection. That's the best English word for it. Now, do you understand the word recollect? Is to gather together what has been scattered. What is the opposite of remember? Obviously, dismember. What has been chopped up and scattered becomes remembered. So in the Christian scheme, Do this in remembrance of me. You see, the Christ has been sacrificed, chopped up. But the Mass is celebrated in remembrance. One of the old liturgies says the wheat which has been scattered all over the hills and grows up is gathered again into the bread. Remembered. Go back to your Hindu basis. The world is regarded as the dismemberment of the self, the Brahman, the Godhead. The one is dismembered into the many. So remembrance is realizing again that each single member of the many is really the one. So that's recollection.
Your It continues with Session 11, An Introduction to Buddhism.
When I was a small boy, I used to haunt that section of London around the British Museum. And one day I came across a shop which had a notice over the window which said, Philosophical Instruments. Even as a boy, I knew something about philosophy. But I couldn't imagine what philosophical instruments could be. So I went up to the window, and there displayed were chronometers, slide rules, scales, and all kinds of what we would now call scientific instruments. Because science used to be called natural philosophy. Because, as Aristotle says, the beginning of philosophy is wonder. Philosophy is man's expression of curiosity about everything, his attempt to make sense of the world primarily through his intellect. That is to say, his faculty for thinking. And thinking, of course, is a word used in extremely many ways and is a very vague word for most people. But I use the word thinking now and hereafter, you must understand this, in a very precise way. By thinking, as distinct from feeling or emoting or sensing, I mean the manipulation of symbols, whether they be words, whether they be numbers, or whether they be other such signs as, say, triangles, squares, circles, astrological signs, or whatever. These are symbols. Sometimes a symbol is a little bit more concrete and less abstract than that, as when you get a mythological symbol, like a dragon. But all these things are symbols, and the manipulation of symbols to represent events going on in the real world is what I call thinking. So, philosophy in the Western sense means generally an exercise of the intellect, and the manipulation of symbols is very largely, until we come to poetry and music, an exercise of the intellect. But it does sometimes go beyond that, as in these specific cases of poetry and music. But what philosophy has become today in the academic world is something extremely restricted. Philosophy, by and large, in the academic world of both the United States and England, Germany, France to some extent, is falling into two other disciplines: mathematical logic on the one hand and linguistics on the other. And the departments of philosophy throughout the academic world have bent over backwards to be as scientific as possible. As William Earle, who was professor of philosophy at Northwestern University, said in an essay called Notes on the Death of a Culture, that an academic philosopher today must above all things avoid being edifying. He must never stoop to lying awake at nights considering problems of the nature of the universe and the destiny of man, because these have largely been dismissed as metaphysical or meaningless questions. So, unworthy of a scientific philosopher who arrives at his office at 9 o'clock in the morning, dressed in a business suit, carrying a briefcase, and does philosophy until 5 in the afternoon, at which point he goes home to cocktails and dinner and dismisses the whole matter from his head. And William Earle adds, he would wear a white coat to work if he could get away with it. This is, of course, a little exaggerated, but this, by and large, is what departmental academic philosophy has become. And Oriental philosophy is simply not philosophy in that sense. These things, Hinduism, Buddhism, and so on, are sometimes also called religions. And I question the application of that word to them, because, again, I like to use the word religion rather strictly. I'm not going to be so bold as to venture a definition of religion, which is supposed to be true for all time. All I can do is to tell you how I use the word religion. And I want to use it in an exact sense from its Latin root, which really means a bond or rule of life. And therefore, the most correct use of the word religion is when we say of a man or woman that he or she has gone into religion, that is to say, has joined a religious or monastic order, and is living under a rule of life, living a life of obedience. For religion, if Christianity is a religion, if Judaism is a religion, if Islam is a religion, they are based on the idea of man's obedient response to a divine revelation. And thus, religion as we understand it in these three forms of religion consists really of three things. We will call them the three C's: the creed, the code, and the cult. The creed is the divinely revealed map of the universe, the nature of things, the revelation of the existence of God, of Allah, Yahweh, or as we say, God, and his existence, and his will, and his design of the universe, the creed. To this we add the second C, the code, the divinely revealed law or exemplar which man is supposed to follow. In the case of Christianity, there's a certain variation in this, because the principal revelation of the code aspect of things in Christianity, as well as the cult, is not so much a law as a person. God is said in Christianity to be supremely revealed in the historic Jesus of Nazareth. And so the code here becomes really the following of Jesus of Nazareth, not so much in obedience to a law as through the power of divine grace. Then finally, the cult. This is the divinely revealed method or way of worship, so that man relates himself to God by prayers, by rites, and by sacraments, which in these particular religions are not supposed to be so much man's way of worshiping God as God's way of loving himself, in which man is involved. So in the Christian religion, say in the Mass, would say that we worship God with God's own worship, following the saying of Meister Eckhart, that great German mystic, the love with which I love God is the same love wherewith God loves me. So too, when monks in a monastery recite the divine office using the Psalms as the basis of it. The Psalms are supposed to be the songs of the Holy Spirit. And so in using the Psalms, the idea is that you worship God with God's own words, and thereby become a sort of flute through which the divine breath plays. Now, neither Hinduism, Buddhism, nor Taoism can possibly be called religions in this sense, because all three of them significantly lack the virtue of obedience. They do not conceive the Godhead as related to mankind or to the universe in a monarchical sense. For you see, there are various models of the universe which men have used from time to time. And the model which lies behind the Judeo-Christian tradition if there really is such a thing, is a political model. Using the metaphor of the relation of an ancient